This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Jens Ludwig, who is the director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. He's also the Edwin and Betty Bergman Distinguished Service Professor of Public Policy. Jens Ludwig founded the Crime Lab 10 years ago to work closely with local government, primarily the Chicago Police Department, to reduce both crime and the harms of the criminal justice system. The Crime Lab is among other ongoing projects working with the Chicago Police Department to reduce gun violence and strengthen police-community relations in the city's most impacted neighborhoods. It partners with the Heartland Alliance and other social service providers to identify and serve young men in the city at highest risk for gun violence. He's also working with the mayor's office in New York City with an ambitious effort to close the Rikers Island Jail. Ludwig began by saying that crime and gun violence is an American problem, not only a Chicago problem, that the homicide rates in cities like Chicago, New York, L.A., Detroit, and Baltimore are outrageous when compared to the rest of the world. Chicago, like New York and L.A., has managed to control their gun violence except for two eras, the 1920s, think of Al Capone, George Bugs Moran in Chicago, and currently. Gun violence, he points out, affects the most disadvantaged in the city of Chicago. If you're a black male between the ages of 15 and 24, 225 homicides per 100,000 people in the population. If you're a Hispanic male in that same age group, 35.6 homicides. And if you're a white male, only 6.9 homicides if you're aged 15 to 24. He talked about the new mayors coming in, whether it be Tony Preckwinkle or Lori Lightfoot. Solving the problem, he said, will be enormously expensive, well into the nine figures. He talked about the consent decree, which recommends more supervisors, more training, more mental health supports, more investigators for citizen complaints. These will all entail huge outlays of capital. He talked about police suicides for all departments in the United States, 18.1%. For Chicago, 29.4%, 60% above the national average. Crime is the number one concern of the public in Chicago, followed by education, taxes, fees, and jobs. Crime, he said, leads to the loss of population and jobs. Every homicide in the city of Chicago, he said, leads to a population loss of 47 people. If Chicago looked like New York with their crime statistics currently, we would have 600 more people living in the city, 3.3 million rather than 2.7 million. The fewer residents, he said, equates to fewer taxpayers. And when you're facing a $33 billion debt and pension that must be met, this is a serious concern. Since 1970, his statistics show fewer middle-class areas of Chicago. He finished up by saying the long-term future of this city relates to how it deals with gun violence. Do we move in the direction of New York and Los Angeles or in the direction of Detroit, which has lost 60% of its population in the last several decades?
Great. Thanks so much to the City Club for having me. Thanks, everyone, for coming. As we're heading into the second round of the mayoral election, living here in Chicago, I think it's very easy to become numb to the public safety problem that's facing the city. You know, we see stories in the newspaper day after day. We read about numbers over and over again. I think it's critically important to keep in mind that behind every single number is a human life. Every one of those lives is valuable. And every one of those lives is connected to a family and a community that's absolutely devastated. A week ago, I was with someone on the staff at the University of Chicago Medical Center who lost her only child. Her son was 23 in 2013 when he was shot and killed going to the corner store in Bronzeville. And we were on a panel together at the lab school, high school where my daughter goes. And she was saying that people ask her all the time, how do you ever heal after something like that? And she said, you don't. I'm a broken person. I'll always be a broken human being. And I think if you look around the city of Chicago, we have far too many broken people all across the city. This is a problem that is facing the city of Chicago, but it's not unique to Chicago. This is really an American problem of gun violence. You can see, so if you look at different cities across the United States, they're so different in their populations. Looking at the total number of homicides is, I think, not the most helpful way to get a sense of the scale of the problem across different places. I think it's much more useful to look at the number of murders per capita. You can see even some of the safest cities in the United States, they have homicide rates that would be absolute crises if they were located in almost any other rich country around the world. You can see that Chicago's got a homicide rate that's substantially higher than the safer U.S. cities. And you can see that there are cities around the country that have murder rates per capita that are even higher than what we have here in the city of Chicago. So while Chicago is not unique in struggling with the gun violence problem, we are in a very unique moment in time right now in the city. So I spend almost all my time looking at crime data and crime graphs, and this one was startling even to me the first time we put this together. So let me talk you through what this graph is showing. This shows you homicide rates per capita going back to 1890. As a way to think about what that means, Benjamin Harrison was president in 1890. Wyoming and Idaho had just been admitted into the Union, and we had horses on our streets instead of cars. So we're going back a long way. And we're showing you the murder rate per capita for the city of Chicago, which is the red line, the murder rate per capita for the city of New York, which is the green line, and the murder rate per capita for Los Angeles, which is the blue line. Okay, I think one thing that you can see in this graph that really stands out is how remarkably similar Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles are for most of this 130-year period, with two important exceptions. One is the 1920s during the Prohibition era, and the other is right now. We are in a very unique moment in time as we're heading into this next mayoral election here in the city. This problem of gun violence is very closely related to inequality across neighborhoods and so many of the city's other social problems. So the gun violence is concentrated in exactly the same neighborhoods where poverty and related social problems are located, on the south side of the city and particularly on the west side of the city. Given the geographic patterning of gun violence across neighborhoods, combined with the enormous amount of income and racial segregation of neighborhoods in the city of Chicago, this leads to enormous differences in mortality rates across race and ethnic lines in the city of Chicago, especially among men. So what this means, put differently, what this means is this is not just a public safety problem. In many ways, this is a public health crisis. Here's one way to think about this. You know, we spend a lot of time, when we think about health in the United States, we spend a lot of time thinking about access to health care and health insurance. We talk about food deserts. We talk about different diseases. But if you look at the data on life expectancy in the United States, one of the most important causes of the black-white disparity in life expectancy in the U.S. is homicide. So here's something that I find enormously weird about the current conversation about public safety in Chicago. So imagine that we had a problem facing the city that was a threat to the future of the city as a place that was a thriving city, a global city. And imagine that everybody in Chicago recognized this as a serious challenge to the city. Imagine that this threat to the future of Chicago was something like the need to expand O'Hare Airport. Okay? What is the first thing that people would be asking? The first thing that people would be asking is, A, how much is it going to cost? And B, is where is that money going to come from? Now, it's possible that I'm living under a rock down in Hyde Park. But I don't hear anyone, I myself don't hear anyone having a serious conversation about this in the city of Chicago right now. Right? These are not the questions that we're asking about the public safety problem. Now, the good news about gun violence is that this is not something that is an unavoidable part of modern urban life, right? One way that we can see that is we can see the fact that Los Angeles and New York have figured out ways to dramatically reduce the amount of gun violence that they experience, okay? It's also the case that we're starting to accumulate evidence from data and different experimentation across cities about different strategies that can be helpful. So one type of strategy people have been trying is to address the root causes that underlie gun violence. Root causes are enormously difficult to change, but I think the good news is that we're seeing different strategies like improving schools, targeting social services, summer jobs, especially for teens, different strategies where we can see in the data that these things are effective in reducing gun violence, diverting people's life trajectories. It's also the case that we have very good evidence that strengthening law enforcement is also a way to reduce crime and reduce gun violence. I think different people are going to look at that list, that menu of possible solutions to the gun violence problem, and given differences in politics, people are going to have different views about which of those they prefer. I think given the scale of the problem, I think we're going to realistically need to be pushing on multiple margins, not just on single strategies to address the problem that we have here. Now, I think there's, whatever the new mayor is going to choose, in terms of a mix of these different strategies to reduce the gun violence problem, if the mayor is proposing a serious solution to the problem, I think one thing that we can be sure of is that it's going to be enormously expensive. How expensive? You should think well into the nine figures. So just think about the scale of resources that we're talking about. There's another very related challenge facing the city that's also going to take serious resources, and that's implementing the city's consent decree for the Chicago Police Department. So if you look at the language of the consent decree, what you can see is that there are a bunch of additional rules and requirements imposed on the Chicago Police Department. But the other thing that the consent decree calls for, was also called for in the Department of Justice report for Chicago Police Department and the Police Accountability Task Force report, is also additional investments in the police department, things like more supervisors, more training, more mental health supports, more investigators for citizen complaints. Why does both the Department of Justice report and the consent decree prioritize additional investments in the police department as well? Well, here's one reason that you can see in the DOJ report for the police department. This shows you the suicide rate among police officers among all departments in the United States and for Chicago. The suicide rate among police officers in Chicago is fully 60% above the national average. There is something going on in the Chicago Police Department that is not good for officers, it's not good for the families of officers, it's not good for anybody in the city of Chicago. And these investments are at least eight figures as well. This is also going to be require serious resources for the city to address. Okay. Now, let me just say one other thing about the consent decree. So it's clear that one of the key goals of the consent decree in Chicago, among the different goals, is to try and improve the relations between the police department and the community in the city of Chicago. Now, if you look at the national conversation about policing in the United States, so not just local to Chicago, but you look nationally and you hear how people are talking about policing, you get the sense from the national conversation that there are a lot of people who want to argue that you can either strengthen police community ties or you can control crime, right? This is language like when police are putting suspects in the car, no need to put your hand over their head, putting them into the car. That's the sort of language that we're talking about. And so I think looking at the experience of the Los Angeles Police Department is, I think, very helpful and revealing in that sense. So let me show you what's in this graph. This is a graph that shows you the homicide rate per capita in the blue line here in Los Angeles over time. And the red line here is public support for the police department over time. Los Angeles is one of those cities that does regular surveying of people all around the city to get their sense for how they're feeling about the police department. I have no idea why we don't do that here in the city of Chicago, but they do it in Los Angeles. And what you can see is Los Angeles figured out a way to greatly improve public safety while simultaneously improving public support for the police department. And what's also relevant here is that in the middle of 2001, LAPD entered its own consent decree with the Department of Justice, and you can see that didn't have any adverse effect on either one of those trends. Okay. So I think the point to take away from this is that it's not inevitable. It's not inevitable that we can reduce crime and strengthen police community ties, but LA suggests that it's possible. Okay. So the next mayor is going to be coming in. They've got a major public safety problem. Any serious solution to this is going to be extremely expensive. And they're trying to do this in a city with a budget situation that's not great. Okay. I think this leads to a very natural sort of next question, which is, can we afford to do this? Okay. One of the things that you can do, there are a bunch of websites out there where if you are thinking about moving to another city, what you can do is enter the city that you're currently living in, Chicago, and enter the city that you're thinking of going, and it'll tell you something about the taxes that you're currently paying and the taxes that you would pay if you moved to a new city. I can't remember why I was on this website. It might have been sometime around the polar vortex. When I had fantasies of moving someplace warmer where it was only, say, minus 20. And if you spend a bunch of time on the web, you can find pretty decent tax aggregators like this, tax calculators that do a reasonably comprehensive job. So they're looking at local as well as state taxes. They're trying to account for sales taxes, income taxes, and property taxes. So this is kind of like all in your tax bill. Okay, and so here's what you see when you do that sort of exercise. I think this is like, it's called the smartassets.com website. And you can see that, like, imagine that you're a household that's right at the poverty line in Chicago. So that's about $25,000 per year for a family of four people. So that's annual income of $25,000. You can see, and they're thinking about living in Chicago versus living in New York City. You can see that if you're towards the bottom of the income distribution and living in Chicago, the taxes that you pay living here are roughly 15% higher than what you'd pay if you lived in New York City instead. Okay. Now, imagine instead that you're a more affluent family with an income of $150,000 per year and you're going through the same exercise. What are the taxes that I'd pay in Chicago versus New York City? If you're a $150,000 a year family, the taxes that you're paying in Chicago are about 15% less than what you're paying if you'd live in New York City. Okay? So, just to be clear about the implications of this, we are living in a city right now that basically gives tax breaks to rich people while poor people get a public health crisis. Okay, that's what we've got going on in Chicago right now. I think there's a different way to think about the question that we might be asking ourselves, which is not can we afford to do this, but rather can we afford not to do this? So if you look at public opinion surveys about what people in the city of Chicago care about, you can see that crime is the number one thing that the public cares about in the city of Chicago. So in some sense, at some sort of very basic level, how weird would it be if we're not willing to invest resources in addressing the thing that most people care most about, right? I think the other way to think about this is look at the number three and the number four concern of the public in the city of Chicago as we're going into the next mayor's election. So crime is number one. taxes, fees, jobs. So basically, taxes in the economy are coming at 3 and 4. And I think there's a bunch of research from social science that tells us that these problems are actually very closely linked. So my colleague Steve Levitt at the University of Chicago did a study a few years ago with someone from the University of California, where they find that every homicide that happens in a city reduces the city's population by fully 70 people. It increases the rate at which people move out, and it decreases the rate at which people are willing to move in. Okay? Now, it's a little bit hard to think about what that means in practice. So every homicide, how many homicides do we have times 70 people? Here's one way to think about what that means in practice. Okay? Imagine the following thought exercise. Imagine that since the early 1990s, so I just showed you in an earlier graph, since the early 1990s, the peak of the crack epidemic, we've had a major divergence in homicide rates per capita between Chicago and New York and LA. Imagine an alternative reality where somehow we had figured out how to have Chicago follow the same homicide trajectory as New York City. What would the city of Chicago look like in 2019 going into this mayoral race? And the answer is we would have fully 600,000 more people living in the city of Chicago than we currently do. 600,000 more people in a city with a current population of about 2.7 million. That's a lot. So some of you might be sitting there thinking, well, who cares? Who cares how big the city is? Well, here's one reason you might care how big the city is, which is we are sitting on, I don't normally think of the Washington Post as a hysterical paper, but when they call your outstanding debt and pension obligations mind-blowing, it's an indication that you might have a problem. Here's one way to think about this, right? The $33 billion in outstanding debt that we have doesn't change, like that number doesn't change if people move in or out. Okay? Somebody, the last man standing in Chicago owes somebody $33 billion. So if you've got a city where more people are moving in, we've got more people to share the burden of paying off that $33 billion debt. We've got a shrinking city, and the outstanding debt obligation per person just gets worse, and as more people leave, you can sort of see how this is not an ideal cycle to be in. There's another way or reason to think about why we care about people leaving the city of Chicago. So this is from some great work that the Voorhees Center at the University of Illinois Chicago have been doing. Some of you might have seen this written up by NPR a couple weeks ago. So this is a graph that shows people at different income levels in the city of Chicago starting in 1970. And so you can just, let me talk you through what this looks like for starters. So dark blue is the very high income part of the distribution. You can see that there are a bunch of, in 1970, there were a bunch of rich people living along the lake and then sort of the outer periphery of the city. Dark red are the lowest income families. You can see that's concentrated on sort of the near south side and the west side of the city. And then this kind of, I don't even know what color you would call that, tan or beige or something, that's middle-class families. Okay? You can see that in 1970, we had a bunch of middle-class families living all over the city. Okay? Now, what's happened with gun violence over time in the city of Chicago? Well, which are the neighborhoods that have gotten much more dangerous over time since sort of the 1960s, early 70s period? It's the west side and the south side. Which are the areas that have gotten dramatically safer over time? As we really do, if you look at the crime trends, it really is a tale of two cities. These north side neighborhoods have gotten a lot safer. And what's been happening to the income distribution in the city of Chicago over time? This is your city of Chicago circa 2017. Okay? You can see that we are living in a city with massive amounts of poverty in exactly those neighborhoods where the gun violence problem is most rampant. And you can see that we have an influx of affluent people in those north side neighborhoods that are becoming much more safe over time. Or put differently, the gun violence problem is not just driving people out, but it's contributing to growing inequality in the city of Chicago itself and all of the follow-on challenges that growing inequality creates for society. Okay. Let me leave you with one more picture. Okay. I think it is not too much to say. I think it is not too much to say that the gun violence problem in some ways is a threat to the very future of the city of Chicago, or at least the city of Chicago as we currently know it. So let me talk you through what this picture is. So this is a graph that shows you the population for a couple different cities expressed as a share of their 1950 population. Okay, so in every year, it's that city's population that year divided by that city's 1950 population. And here's what you can see. So the green line here is New York City, and you can see that New York City in sort of the 1970s and 80s was a struggling city, losing people. And New York City managed to turn it around since then, I think in large part, or in, at least in part, because of the substantial improvements in public safety there. And you can see that today New York City is, if anything, a little bit bigger than it was back in 1950. Okay? In contrast, look what happened to the city of Detroit from 1950 to today. The city of Detroit lost fully 60% of its population. Okay? Now, the question that you want to ask yourself is, where does Chicago fall in this graph? And the answer is almost exactly in the middle between New York City and Detroit. Okay? So I think in many ways the question for the city of Chicago is which direction we're going to go in the future. Are we going to go in the direction of a thriving city like New York, or are we going to go in the direction of a dying city like Detroit? And I think every year as we go, every mayoral election, I think that question becomes more and more critical for the city to answer. Thank you very much.
Much.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to grab my
incredible presentation with a lot of interesting observations. If anybody has any questions that they would like to ask Jens, just hold up your blue slip. I see we have one here. And we have two, and there's one over there, one in the back of the room. We'll try to answer as many of these questions as is possible. This is from Dwayne Deskin, City Club member, who's a former federal prosecutor. His question, Jens, as New York and LA have reduced crime over time, what has held Chicago back from adopting similar strategies decades ago? What must change?
Yeah, it's a great question about what the differences are between Los Angeles and New York. I think there are lots of differences. Everyone in the room has been to LA and New York before, and obviously you've been to Chicago. If you look at the cities, it's easy to point to lots of things that are very different across the cities as explanations for why the crime rates are so different. So the population density is so much different in New York than in Chicago, and you know we're much closer to states with lax gun laws like Indiana and so on than New York is. And I think that the challenge for any of these explanations is that in say 1990, 1991. New York City's homicide rate was almost exactly like Chicago's. So, like, from 1991 to today, Chicago didn't get any closer to Indiana, right? So the explanation has to come from something that changed over time. something that changed over time in New York that didn't change in the same way in Chicago. And I think if you went to like the annual meetings of the American Society of Criminology, which I would not recommend anybody here ever does. But if you did that and you did a survey of members and you asked them what explains the departure of LA and New York from Chicago, I think what most criminologists would say is policing plays a big role between the two cities. So I think it's not what the criminologists would say is that it's not an accident that Bill Bratton was police commissioner in both of those cities and implemented a bunch of management innovations that I think many people believe contributed to reductions in crime. I think the other thing that happened in New York that gets less attention, but I think many people in sort of the criminology economics of crime world believe is very important as well, is over the course of the 1990s, New York increased the size of its police department from something like 30,000 to 40,000. So as a way to think about that, the Chicago Police Department itself barely has more than 10,000 officers. So imagine taking every Chicago cop, putting them on a bus, and sending them east on 9094 to New York City, and deploying them in the most economically disadvantaged parts of the city. That's going to make a big difference. Okay, I think the one other thing that New York is that's different about New York, although it's a little bit harder to tell in the data to what degree this matters in practice, is over the course of the 1990s, a bunch of hedge fund people got together and started something called the Robin Hood Foundation, which I think at its peak, they would have these amazing galas at the Jacob Javits Center where Katy Perry would do whatever it is that Katy Perry does, and they'd raise something like $300 million in one night. And they'd give it away in poor neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. And to me, I think importantly, they would also do that in a very data-driven way, right? They'd really pay very careful attention to what the data suggests is effective in helping improve the lives of poor families. I think that New York City is lucky that they've got a Wall Street that they can draw on for that. Although Chicago itself has a bunch of big, a very long, illustrious philanthropic history as well. So,
okay, thank you, Jens. Boy, we have a lot of questions here. Some are statements, and some people are afraid to put their real name on, but that question won't be asked. This is from City Club member Tom Donovan. Could you superimpose the New York Rudy Giuliani years on the graph to show if his influence on crime reduction? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, crime went down everywhere in the United States in the night. So let's just be clear, like what has happened. Crime went down everywhere in the United States in the 1990s, not just New York City, not just L.A. It did decline in Chicago as well, just not nearly as much as in Los Angeles and New York. So I think, the Rudy Giuliani consulting firm is benefiting a lot from the fact that they were riding the tailwind of this national kind of reduction in crime.
Okay, this is from, I can only read your first name because I can't read your last name. It's unintelligible. Robert with the Chicago Peace Fellows. Where are you, Robert? Over there. Robert, you're not a member of the City Club. I'm going to make you a wonderful offer. $50. Cash, credit, debit card, no other test. We won't run your fingerprints, no saliva, nothing. You're a member of the City Club. Anyhow, he has a very good question. In L.A., there is a community oversight commission that has been implemented. How critical is community oversight to improve police-community relations? I think that's the thrust of his question.
Yeah, I think if whatever happened in Los Angeles, I think is feels to me like an amazing success story, right? Again, I think looking at the national conversation, so many people want to say, like, you can either reduce crime or you can improve police-community relations, and I think you just look at the data in L.A., and it shows that that's a false choice. That's not the trade-off that you're locked into. I'm not sure. I would be very doubtful that it was just one single thing in LA that contributed to that, partly because we saw such a steady increase in police community relations. From the sort of the early mid-1990s, like predating the consent decree and, you know, different sort of community oversight organizations. I certainly think that lots of people in Chicago are going to be looking to the LA experience and what lessons can be drawn from that, from the implementation of the consent decree here. And I think we can only hope that we have sort of a similar experience in the city of Chicago as well.
Okay, thank you, Jens. This is from John McLeese, retired City Club member. Does the Crime Lab have plans to duplicate in Chicago the program it has undertaken in New York to reduce the number of people who fail to show up for their court dates, resulting in an issuance of an arrest warrant?
Oh, yeah. So most people probably don't know what that means. So New York City, one of the things that the police department has been trying to do is reduce the amount of serious contact that people in New York have with the criminal justice system. They call it precision policing, sort of. Worry about the serious stuff and the people most at risk for, doing shootings and robberies, but have as light a touch as possible for everything else. And so one of the things that NYPD has been doing is they've been giving out more and more tickets for minor offenses. So you get caught peeing in an alley, they give you something called a summons. It's basically a ticket that says that you've got to come to court, whatever, May 2nd. And, the criminal justice system, so many people don't go to court. And the criminal justice system, like their sort of default view of people not coming to court is this is willful disobedience, and so we're going to issue an arrest warrant, right? I mean, which is what you do if you think that people are willfully defying the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system can't function if people don't show up to court, so you bring the hammer. So we partnered with a behavioral science organization in New York City called Ideas 42 that was motivated by a different hypothesis for why people don't come to court, which is that they're people, right? So, the year that I remember my own wedding anniversary will be the year that my wife dies of a heart attack. Much less remember when you go to. I don't think there's any need to tell my wife that I said that here.
Although it's being, transmitted live. And there's a podcast.
No, I know my wife well enough to know this is the last thing that she wants to see. So what we basically did is we worked with Ideas 42 to set up a better system of reminding people that they've got to go to court. There's another sort of insight from behavioral science, a trick that we've seen successful in lots of different areas, which is like not just reminding people, but getting them to make a plan in advance. It's like, oh my God, I've got a 6-year-old kid and school lets out at 3 and the court date is at 2. I might not be back in time, so I got to get childcare, right? That's not the sort of problem that you want to start thinking about how to solve the morning of your court date, right? And so we found that just by doing these like very, very light touch kind of behavioral science changes generated something like a 10 or 15% reduction in failure to appear rates in court. And there's absolutely no reason that, in principle, you couldn't do that in Chicago or any other city across the country.
Okay, your cup is dry.
You're the barkeep. Perfect.
Tremendous.
Great.
Okay, this is from Beverly Graham. Beverly, where are you? Back there? Okay, good. What do you see as the most concerning issues about EM in the pretrial phase of adjudication?
Most people don't know what EM. So EM is electronic monitoring, okay? And, I think that, here's the original logic behind electronic monitoring. So Cook County, you have people who get arrested and then you go in front of a judge and the judge is supposed to decide whether you get released or not based on a prediction for whether you're a rearrest risk or a flight risk. Okay, and there are a bunch of cases where the system is worried that people might get rearrested, or they're worried that they might not come back to court, and then the judge is in this difficult position of do I let them go or do I put them in jail? Where in most cities, it can take 2 to 4 months to resolve a case, which is a huge negative impact on people's lives. And so I think people in the criminal justice system have been very eager for a door number C. Isn't there something between just letting people go and, you know, harming their lives like this by 2 to 4 months in jail? And so there's an enormous attraction, especially as like GPS technology gets better over time, to do things like electronic monitoring, where we're trying to have some sort of control or supervision over people's lives without necessarily having to detain them. But that system itself also creates a bunch of potential traps for people, right? And, you know, the technology is not as reliable as you would like. People forget that they're on it. And I think this is something that lots of cities are doing but struggling with. I think a different way to think about resolving this problem, which we're working with New York City on right now, is there's a different sort of angle for helping judges get out of this problem, which is, you know, think about the task that the judge is asked to do. The judge is asked to form a prediction of somebody's risk. How the hell would you do that, right? This is exactly the sort of thing that psychology and behavioral science research tells us is super difficult for any human being to do. And the judges, being human beings, have a struggle with it, as we all would if we were in their shoes. And they wind up detaining a bunch of low-risk people inadvertently, because it's hard to tell who's low-risk and who's high-risk. And they wind up letting a bunch of high-risk people go. And, you know, if you look at the data, what you can see is that the vast majority of people are actually low risk. And the data actually does a pretty decent job of helping you isolate the small subset of people who are high risk. And if you sort of do the math with this, you can help the judges see who the high risk people are and just get them to prioritize detention on that. You can substantially reduce, so the calculations that we did, you can reduce the jail population, at least in the New York context, you can reduce the jail population by fully 40% without any increase in crime at all, just by helping judges do a better job of prioritizing who really is high risk. So I think that, my guess is going to be, given all of the potential traps of EM and the enforcement challenges for the government, my guess is that more and more jurisdictions across the country are going to start thinking more seriously about helping judges really figure out who's high risk, who's low risk.
Okay. This is from Judy Griffin with J. Griffin and Associates. Judy, where are you? Right over here on my far right. There has been pressure to eliminate some police profile databases. Will this loss of data make it more difficult to reduce crime?
Sorry, say the question again.
There has been pressure to eliminate some police profile databases. Will the loss of data make it more difficult to reduce crime?
What do you mean by police profile databases?
The police department has access to a specific database that they've been building, and some of the candidates have talked about eliminating it.
This is like the contact card database?
Yes.
Yeah.
Gang.
I'm sorry?
Gang database.
Oh, the gang database. The gang database. Yeah, So the gang database. I think that this is one of those questions where on its face it seems like it has an easy answer, but as you start to think about this a little bit more, maybe the answer is not so easy. So I think the downsides of a gang database are very easy to see. Okay, but now imagine, like, put yourselves in the shoes of the person who's running the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. Or you put yourself in the shoes of the person running the Cook County Jail. And I've got people who are assigned to pretrial detention in my facility, right? And I know that, like, the 4-6 terror is going back and forth doing a bunch of shootings with some faction of the Satan Disciples. Okay? Now I've got a 16-year-old kid coming into my facility or an 18-year-old guy coming into my facility. Do I want to know what gang faction he's in? Do I want to know what gang faction everybody else is in? I think that's one illustration. I think as another sort of example, a lot of the, like, people like Andy Papakristos at Northwestern has shown that a lot of the violence in the city of Chicago is closely related to this sort of gang structure. right? And another thing that newspapers like the Chicago Tribune have been spending a lot of attention on is the absolutely abysmal clearance rate for homicides in the city of Chicago. Abysmal. So I think right now we're something like, there are different definitions for the clearance rate, but it's something like, call it 20 or 30% for homicides and call it 5 to 7% for non-fatal shootings. Think about that. Think about that. Right? And so, you know, you have shootings where, you know, would it be useful to know the gang affiliation of the suspect in a shooting? Would it be useful to know what gang they're feuding with and who's a member of that gang so you can reallocate patrol activities and everything else? I think that's what it's sort of like the public safety benefits of this, I think, are a little bit murkier and hard to see than the downsides of the gang database. And so I think it's like this one to me feels a little more complicated than it initially seems.
Okay, thank you. We'll try to get a few more questions in. This is from Lindsay LaPointe, City Club member with the BPI, Business for Professional Interest. Lindsay, where are you?
Right
up here. Okay, good. In your expert opinion, do prisons make us safer? What are the implications of this for the new mayor's policies on crime and her use of the mayoral megaphone?
Yeah, so if you look at sort of the national conversation around incarceration in the United States right now, I think that there are, you know, I didn't show you a graph of the trends in incarceration in the United States, but I think most people have probably seen this before. If you go back to the 1970s, we increased the number of people per capita in prisons and jails in the United States by a factor of something like four to seven. So we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. Everyone knows, everyone in this room knows that that has very disproportionately affected the most disadvantaged communities in the United States. So everybody realizes that this is a problem. I think that there are a bunch of very well-intentioned people who look at that trend and for reasons that I understand why they're saying it, but they're saying things like, prisons don't actually make you safer, prisons make us less safe. And they're entering into alliances with people on the right side of the political aisle, like the Koch Foundation. And I find that, I think if you look at the data, so here's what almost everybody who does research on this question would say. They would say that prisons actually do reduce crime, but there are much more effective ways to reduce crime. Okay? But notice what happens if you say that prisons literally don't do anything to crime, right? Or actually might even cause crime to go up. You enter into an alliance with people who are on the right side of the political aisle, and you know, you think what you're doing is cutting prison populations to free up money for social programs and on and on and on. The people on the right side of the aisle say, we're more than happy to cut prisons, right? But there's no need to reinvest, to do justice reinvestment. You've just told me that none of this prison stuff actually does anything to crime anyway. And so I think it makes me nervous that this is an example of kind of like a short-term tactical argument that people are making that's not consistent with the data that might actually inadvertently undermine the goal of reducing incarceration in a sustainable way where you're actually putting money back into other things that will keep communities safe, because the violence, I mean, as you saw in the presentation, the violence problem is harming exactly the same communities as the incarceration problem.
You had to give a yes or no.
Maybe. How about that?
Prison. That's a typical social scientist. Okay. Glad to hear that. I myself have attended about four of these mayoral forums. And on one of your graphs, you said that for the people in Chicago, crime is the highest priority item compared to some other things. Yet both mayoral candidates, for example, said that they're against a new police and fire training academy, and particularly in the neighborhood that it has been suggested. And unless I've been mistaken, when I listen to their responses on how to deal with crime and the issues, they really haven't grabbed the bull by the horns. They're kind of politicking their way through and evading. What will the new mayor have to do shortly or immediately upon entering office to address that issue?
The academy specifically?
Sure.
You know, I think that, if you look at New York City, they built something like a $750 million police training academy. And New York City does an enormous amount of investment in training and other supports for police officers. Chicago Police Department does very little training for officers once they're on the job. We do remarkably little mental health and wellness supports historically for police officers. And if you've ever been to the training academy, the current training academy on the west side of the city, it's not great. The nicest thing that you could say about it is that it's not great, and if you had more time, I could tell you lots of other ways to talk about it. There's a way to look at New York City and say, like, oh, those people clearly don't know what they're doing, spending that much money on a training academy for the police and putting all this money into making the police department as effective as possible. On the other hand, you look at the graph that I showed you before, where the current homicide, I don't know what the latest numbers are, the current, you know, in recent years, the homicide rate in Chicago has been between like 23 and 28 per 100,000. I think this year in New York City, it's like 3 or 4 per 100,000, right? And so maybe that's an example of, you know, a lesson that we could take from New York.
Okay, we just have time for one or two questions. I've tried to combine a couple, and we could go on forever. This is from a Jackie Moore with Agape Works. Jackie, where are you? Right straight out there. She says she's empathetic toward the rising suicide rate among Chicago Police Department officers. She's curious, how does that rate compare to the general overall population suicide rate?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually don't know the. I think it's Rosanna Ander from the Crime Lab is giving me the universal sign for it's much higher among police officers than the general public. Yeah.
Good point. Thank you for coming.
I mean, in some ways, it would be remarkably. It would be shocking if it weren't much higher than for the general population. If you think about the. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about undiagnosed trauma. We spend a lot of time appropriately talking about undiagnosed trauma for kids growing up in the South and West Side neighborhoods where gun violence problem is so prevalent, right? But for every one of those shootings, a Chicago police officer comes to the scene and sees exactly the same thing that every kid and every mom and on sees in those neighborhoods as well. And we don't talk about undiagnosed trauma among police officers, and you have to think that that's at least as severe as what it is for all the kids growing up in these neighborhoods.
Terrific. I've tried to combine a couple of questions here. Suzanne Malik McKenna had a question, so did Andy Wade from Build, Bruce Handler, and so on. And basically, they're concerned about the money, the resources, to reallocate and rethink for integrated solutions to this issue. New revenue, for example, from potential marijuana legislation may be the largest source of new dollars on the horizon. What portion of those resources, in your opinion, should be set aside to reinvest in neighborhoods like Austin and the South Side high crime areas, criminal justice reform, and so on?
So, you know, The dollar figures that I've seen from the marijuana legalization in Illinois and in Chicago, I think that if I have the numbers right, I don't think that is anywhere near the solution to the budget challenges for the city of Chicago, for the state of Illinois. I think you really have to be thinking about entirely new revenue sources for the city. And I think a thing that everybody, I think, implicitly has in mind is we're petrified to talk about raising taxes in the city of Chicago if you live here, as I do, because you're worried that people are just going to move right across city lines into Oak Park, into Evanston, into Homewood Flossmoor, and so on, right? Because we know that holding all else equal, higher taxes drives people out, right? But if you sort of think about the new mayor coming in and making investments in public safety, you're not holding all else equal, right? If we are generating new revenues and putting them into things that make the city safer, here's another thing that we know drives people from the city: gun violence. You have a shooting on your block, you're leaving the city of Chicago, right? And so raising taxes and for something like public safety, you have an offsetting kind of effect on retaining population in the city, and it's very possible that we've been sort of overly conservative and worried about the adverse effects of taxes on population without realizing these other kinds of collateral risks that we're creating that are driving people out of the city, especially on the south and west sides.
Thank you. I have a question here. Has anybody ever heard of Roscoe Conkling? No, because you're all too young. This had to be given by a gray-haired person or lady, because Roscoe Conkling was the principal on the R. Miss Brooks television show. So, Roscoe, because you were a chicken, to give us your real name, your question will not be asked. It's great to be the moderator. Now, Jens, first of all, let's give him a big round of applause.